Track 13, Jeremiah James Coleman, entrepreneur, paternalist, public benefactor, and off-spinner. This is the man who took Coleman's from a small enterprise and made it the household name for mustard, and he was a remarkable individual.
Jeremiah Coleman is perhaps the most fondly remembered of the small group of non-conformist and enlightened entrepreneurs whose industry, drive, and commitment to their community was largely responsible for returning Norwich to prosperity in the second half of the 19th century, and rightly so. Norwich, whose long-term wealth had depended on almost entirely on its worsted business, had declined significantly in economic importance as that industry failed to modernize, and found itself prey to the more forward-looking moguls of Manchester. It was into this background that Jeremiah's great-uncle, also Jeremiah, had launched his plant at Stoke Mill to manufacture mustard, later taking into partnership Jeremiah's father, James. It was a successful business, but little more than a cottage industry. After 20 years, the staff numbered less than 30, and James mixed the entire output by hand before it was packed into casks by just one man, Lazarus Horn, who managed to do the job despite having only one arm. The casks were labelled by James's wife. Jeremiah joined the firm at 17 and became a partner at 21, and at 24, on the death of his father, took overall responsibility for the Norwich end of the business. He did so with some trepidation, writing to his mother about the responsibilities of his role, saying it would not be smooth work at such a young age. He need hardly have worried. By the time he had finished, the workforce was around 2,000, with at least as many other jobs in Norwich depending on the success of Coleman's. And by 1880, the production required no less than 12,000 railway wagons to deal with the 927,229 casks of mustard it manufactured. Even with two arms, Lazarus Horn would have struggled with that. Jeremiah's acumen was extraordinary, and his influence was all-pervasive. He revolutionized everything. His first task was to manage the company's move from Stoke Mill to Carrow. It was an inspired choice. The Carrow site offered excellent communication by rail and river as well as road, and the prospect of being able to recruit large numbers of workers was greatly improved. The extent of his involvement in the original choice is unknown, the site selected before he became a partner. But the execution of the move was entirely his. The move completed, he was able to take advantage of the opportunities offered by the scale of the new site. In everything he did, he ensured that his employees benefited too. There are three separate strands to Coleman's achievements. Coleman, the hugely successful businessman, Coleman, the paternalist employer, and Coleman, the public figure and benefactor. Underlying each was a firm commitment to the Christian faith, accompanied by a huge dose of what later became known as the Protestant work ethic. Jeremiah's biggest single contribution was his mastery of marketing. He was one of the earliest, perhaps along with Lever, to understand the value of branding, a technique virtually unknown. Its value was questioned by other businessmen, one of whom was foolish enough to tell Lever it was a waste of time. Lever, in response, asked the critic which mustard he used. "Coleman's, of course," came the reply. "Is there another?" Lever had made his point. By that time, the words mustard and Coleman's were virtually synonymous. Coleman himself chose the Bull's Head logo and the corporate colours which remain in use today and were, according to Jeremiah, first used in 1855, a remarkable lifespan for a logo. To promote the brand, Coleman moved away from distributing the product in anonymous casks for retailers to measure out to sell to customers in anonymous packaging. Instead, he distributed the product pre-packed in a range of sizes and in attractive containers, all in the corporate colours and bearing the logo and details of prizes and royal warrants the product had won. Packing the product thus required a substantial increase in staff, mostly girls, As a result, the proportion of women workers in Norwich was soon higher than the national average. The product was increasingly distributed by rail, in vans painted the corporate colours and bearing the logo. Even the wagons bringing fuel into the yard bore the logo, Coal for Coleman's Mustard Works. The outlay for these changes was amply repaid in increasing sales, but Coleman kept a firm eye on costs as well. He made tins for new packs on site. The labels were printed there, and even the paper on which they were printed was manufactured in-house. He set up two separate advertising departments, one to promote goods through the retailers, the other to undertake outside advertising to promote the brand. Retailers were provided with a range of promotional gifts, branded pencils, matchbox holders, and pipe bowls. After Jeremiah's time, they even came up with the bizarre Zeppelin raid detector, which it claimed would indicate the likelihood of a raid in World War I if the customer input details such as wind direction and cloud cover. Meanwhile, the outside department produced items such as the tin plate adverts displayed at the railway stations through which the Coleman trains passed. Coleman's employees were undoubtedly better looked after than many others. Coleman was one of those at that time like Salt, Lever and Rowntree, who took responsibility for the well-being of their staff. Many didn't. At Coleman's, the tradition actually predated Jeremiah. His mother had been responsible for the care of staff, and when Jeremiah married his second cousin Caroline, he had chosen a partner ideally suited to continue and develop this approach. Education mattered to them, and Coleman's opened its own school. Nutrition and health were also a focus, and the works kitchen produced daily menus, which employees could enjoy on a segregated basis, the use of the facilities being split by gender. In 1864, a dispensary was opened, attended once a week by a doctor, and Coleman broke entirely new ground with the appointment of Philippa Flowerday as an industrial nurse, the first recorded such appointment in the country. If their ministrations failed, then the employer's coffin would be provided by Coleman, having been made on site. He also established sickness insurance schemes and a rudimentary pension arrangement. Perhaps the most intriguing aspect of Coleman's paternalism was his conviction that self-help was vital. Employees were required to make a modest contribution to enjoy almost all these benefits, though the coffins were free. He must surely have read avidly Samuel Smiles' Self-Help, published in 1859. The firm benefited from the goodwill it generated. Although Coleman, unlike many of his contemporaries, was willing to allow labour to organise, there is little evidence of unrest. At Christmas in 1892, the counting house department even performed a song, lauding Coleman's products and their worldwide popularity. Coleman was also a man who took his civic responsibilities seriously. He served successively as a councillor, as sheriff, as mayor, and as an alderman. He also sat as a magistrate and was appointed deputy lieutenant. He was elected to Parliament as a Liberal and became a close enough friend of Gladstone for them to stay at each other's homes. They both had substantial libraries of theological works which they used to exchange. Gladstone's visit to the Colemans at their coastal property at Courton was a sad occasion, as, while staying there, Gladstone learned of the death of his son. Coleman himself suffered a similar loss when he took his son Alan to Egypt in the hope that the climate might improve his health. He had been diagnosed with TB, only for Alan to die out there. Coleman was to become a major benefactor to Norwich, donating the land the Jenny Lind Children's Hospital was built on, and also providing the cricket ground at Lakenham, where Norfolk played their home fixtures until the year 2000. Ironically, one of those to play for the county there was the grandson of Lazarus Horn, the cask packer. He only played once, failing to trouble the scorers. Cricket was an interest of Jeremiah, who had been quite a serious young man, giving talks on subjects such as sea anemones. Cricket was an outlet, and he was a good off-spinner. The family had its own 11. When I was researching a book on 19th-century Norfolk entrepreneurs, Sir Timothy Coleman told me of a lovely family tradition that the 11, in order to field a holy family team, had to include a relation with a wooden leg, who kept wicket. When they played a match against Leatheringset, the village were dismissed for 77, Jeremiah taking 7 wickets with his off breaks. The fact that the highest contributor was 20 in byes suggests that the family tradition may be correct. Jeremiah Coleman was a remarkable man who, one suspects, was able to square his determination to achieve almost a monopoly on the production of mustard with his social conscience, because he believed he was doing God's work by providing work, education, medical care, and even homes for those who would otherwise go without. As a last thought, and writing for an Archant-owned magazine, I should perhaps add that Coleman was one of the founders of what is now the Eastern Daily Press. A fuller account of Jeremiah Coleman's story can be found in Chris Armstrong's book, Mustard, Boots and Beer, Lark's Press, 2014.